I want to start today to talk about the Wars of Liberation, which stand at the beginning of modern history. German, French, and English are the wars of the French Revolution. These wars which are the concrete background to the new nationalism I discussed in these last lectures. These wars of the French Revolution, wars of national liberation as they were regarded by those who fought them, made theory reality. And of course, reality interacted again with the theory that we have talked about. And though Herder and Rousseau, of course, never knew these wars of national liberation, nevertheless, the kind of ideas which they put forward were made reality through the catalyst of the revolution and the wars that followed. And once I've discussed these wars of national liberation, I will return to Hegel, that is to say, the system of thought which pulls it all together, most of what we have studied, the Enlightenment, Romanticism, and the new nation. Now, last time I already mentioned that the Jacobins in France, during the Revolution, pioneered what Rousseau had advised the people of Poland to institute, namely a political liturgy, which the Poles never had a chance to institute, but the Jacobins in reality practiced. But the wars of national liberations followed these wars and spread the ideas still more widely. They were the first wars in European history since ancient times to be fought not by mercenaries but by citizen armies. They had therefore quite a different qualities than the earlier wars where people had fought for money and not for a cause. Both in France and England, those who stood out were the volunteers who rushed through the to the colors. A new kind of thing, because mercenaries are not volunteers. So then in the wars of France to defend the revolution, in the wars of Germany for national liberation, it were the volunteers that came to the color, accompanied by a great elan to save the revolution, to found the new nation, new flags, new songs like the Marseillaise, in which they went to war. In Germany, these corps of volunteers were called the Free Corps. And around these Free Corps, as they were known in Germany, there grew up legend and poetry, so much so that the same title was adopted, Free Corps, after 1918, when it was once again a matter of avenging defeat, of pulling the nation together after the First World War. Indeed, in Germany, but also in France, the legend of these wars was never to die down, to be a continuous inspiration. For it was the first time that you have this elan of volunteering for the nation, of citizen armies going out to fight with all that that meant. These young men who went out to fight were only a minority. Most were drafted, but about those history was silent, for they did not make a legend or a myth for the future, those who were drafted. And in Prussia or in France, most were drafted, few volunteered. But it is the myth of the volunteer that is important, for it will be the myth that is active, that will never die down, and that will give body, if I can put it that way, to the new nationalism. As a matter of fact, In the German Wars of Liberation, there were a few volunteers. Recruiting was very slow, and that's why there had to be, in the end, a draft. Moreover, a lot of vagabonds and undesirables became part of the recruits. But about those, again, history is silent. It is the myth made by poets and writers who themselves were volunteers. And in Germany, above all, by one poet who had the luck of being killed in the war, which inherits his poetry no end, namely the poet, I don't see any chalk, Theodor Körner, K-O-R-N-E-R. Theodor Körner, one of the great poets of the Wars of Liberation, whose collection of poetry was called The Lyre and the Sword, the poetry and the sword. And Körner was killed in a battle against the French, and both he and his poetry became, as it were, a kind of symbol of the war itself. Now, quite clearly, what became all important in these wars was death, because wars are about death. But death has to be disguised, because if wars are really about death, nobody would go to war. So you have to disguise the death. And so these are the first wars where death for the fatherland becomes something desirable, something to be wished for. The only way of dying and not to be dead at all. The only way of dying and to living. Whilst people who die in their beds die. People who die for the fatherland do not die at all. They live on. They live on. All of this becomes, again, myth and legend. Myth of legend of important sort. And I will give you only one example. You can read the Marseillaise itself. The Marseillaise in France is full of these ideas. But the most important, undoubtedly, Central European example is the... Now, I've lost the chalk. Well, can't be helped. Is the poet made for one of the most famous Free Corps by the German... here it is. By the German poet... Friedrich Schiller, a poet every German schoolboy up to my generation will certainly know by heart. Every German will know by heart up to my generation. The poem goes this way, essentially, and it will give you an idea of how body was given to this idea of the nation, especially through soldiering, through death on the battlefield, which, as I said, is now not death at all. Typically enough, it is now that into Protestant service, memorial for the fallen was entered. That was unknown in Christian service. But it's now that you get in Christian service a memorial for the fallen, sanctified. Both before they went into battle, they were blessed in church. And after they were fallen, they were blessed in church as well. A kind of double insurance, because they lived on in the fatherland, and they lived on, and the church gave its approval. Schiller's poem goes this way, and it is typical for all volunteers in all wars. It is typical for the generation of 1914, which sang this song, as it is in Germany for the generation of 1813. Which sang this song. In a world, says Schiller, out of which freedom has vanished, a world which knows only masters and serfs, only the soldier is free. And only the soldier is free in a world which knows only masters and serfs, because he can look death into the eye. He is rid of the anxieties of life. He has nothing to fear. He has no sorrows, no worries of daily life. He has left daily life behind him. He is riding on his horse, facing fate, And if it doesn't hit him today, it will hit him tomorrow. In other words, there is here the feeling that this transcends daily life, that he leaves his wife and children behind, that he becomes sanctified, something exceptional, that the boredom, if you like, of bourgeois life, then after all rather new, later on rather old, that the boredom of bourgeois life has been transcended by the soldier who looks death in the eye, who is truly free because he has nothing left to fear. He has transcended daily life. He rides towards his fate, which can hit him at any moment. Therefore, go on daily. It ends with a very famous line, difficult to translate. Youth is full of enthusiasm. Youth is full of life. So youth is brought into intimate connection with death, but with the exceptional. Not with a bourgeois death in bed, but death is life. Youth is full of life, full of the exceptional, leaves bourgeois life behind, faces death, but it is really no death at all, because death is life. And the other famous poem, very famous as well, in which a youth who has fallen is not death at all, is the most famous soldier poem in German, or indeed, I think, in Central European history, written for the Wars of Liberation by Ludwig Uhland, called The Good Comrade. I'm sure many of you have heard it. Ein guter Kamerade, a good comrade. I had a good comrade. You won't find a better one. And eventually, a bullet came, and is it for me or is it for you? It is for him. But he lies at my feet as if it were a piece of myself. Now, I don't doubt that Der gute Kamerade is the most popular soldier song of all time. But again, it is the most popular soldier song of all time, because the dead is not dead. He is a continuation of yourself. And this song combines two things. It combines death on the battlefield with comradeship, the two principal and strongest myths of the Wars of Liberation and of all subsequent wars of the generation of 1914. First of all, the longing for the exceptional, the longing for great deeds, the longing for an out of the boring and dreary lives in which people are forced. Wives of diaper smells and families and nagging wives or nagging husbands. And second of all, it combines that again with a longing for a true community. Here, symbolized in these wars by the comradeship of war, by the German Free Corps. In France, there are similar things in the armies of the Revolution. So the comrade isn't dead. He is a part of you. Because he is a comrade, a community of affinity, and because he has died in the same cause, a cause which guarantees not only an end for boredom, but eternal life. And which of you would not like to sacrifice itself for that? So, in other words, this is, after all, the great legend. The cult of the fallen soldier is without doubt, an essential part of the kind of nationalism that we have discussed, of the idea of community of affinity, of spontaneity, of your ancestors, of historical continuity. All of this. And to give you one final example, again, from a tract of the Wars of Liberation. Under all ways of dying, And sooner or later, we all have to die. The death for the fatherland is the sweetest. It is the death of Christ itself, because it is a death to save the community. So in the last resort, as throughout the wars of liberation, throughout eventually the First World War, the analogy is between the fatherland and Easter, the resurrected fatherland and the resurrection of Christ. And in dying for the fatherland, you are doing an imitation of Christ, an imitation of Christ which guarantees you the resurrection. You become, in fact, a part of the most basic pattern of our civilization, the pattern of death and resurrection, the pattern of the death and resurrection of Christ. Now, these ideas are not yet objectified in military cemeteries and monuments for the fallen. That only comes after the First World War. Mass death is not yet. Therefore, you do not yet have military cemeteries and monuments for the fallen. But you already have the beginning of that the nation is making its own church, its own temple, its own martyrs. There can be no cause without martyrs. Its own martyrs. But at the same time that you have this, you have the institutionalization of all this, the community, the death, the enthusiasm. And the man who it was institutionalized in France through the Jacobins, through the festivals that I have dealt with, through the kind of conformity the Jacobins enforced, the kind of outward signs of enthusiasm, the cap, the sash, the colors, the flag, the songs. Now in Germany, you had all of this, the national anthems, the flags, all of this. But you also had, in a country occupied, two other institutions, all founded by the same man whom you might call the institutionalizer of German and indeed of Central European nationalism. Because remember, what Germany did was imitated by the rest of the nations of Central Europe. Friedrich Ludwig Jahn, professor of folklore at the newly founded University of Berlin, a colleague of Fichte, whom I mentioned last time, founded two organizations which we would call today. They are founded as guerrilla organizations to fight against the occupiers, to fight two liberation fronts, or we would say national liberation fronts, both founded in 1810, 1811. One was the fraternity movement, for the students were the pioneers. The students are the articulate. Remember one thing, in industrial societies, students are unimportant. In societies not yet industrialized, students, as the only articulate segment of that society, become its leaders, as you know, in the Third World today. So Germany is not yet industrialized. Students are still important. And therefore, students become, in a way, the leaders because of their articulateness. This, of course, will vanish with industrialization. But at the moment, the students are the leaders. So the fraternity movement became central. Central in more ways than one. First of all, it was a pledge to national liberation. In 1918, the fraternities met at Luther's castle, the castle where Luther had translated the German Bible, the castle where the German language was founded, the famous Wartburg Castle. Typically enough, they made the connection. But it isn't only Luther who is connected with the Wartburg where they met. Something else important is connected with the Wartburg: Tannhäuser, the Minnesingers. Wagner's Tannhäuser plays at the Wartburg. The Minnesingers met at the Wartburg. Tannhäuser, the Minnesingers. So in meeting at the Wartburg, you made a connection with the medieval Germany. before modernity. You met the connection with the first German liberator, Martin Luther. And there the students met, took an oath off to defend the fatherland with their lives, and did something else, which shows you the growing aggressiveness. Burnt books. Not only books, they also burnt the swords of the nobility, the breeches of the nobility, clothes which the nobles had worn. For from the beginning, the fraternity movement was a democratic movement. Just as from the beginning, remember, nationalism was democratic. So what the students put on their fire in the courtyard of Wartburg Castle were not only French books, books written, as they thought, against German unity, but they burnt as well all the accoutrements, the signs of class difference, which in those days meant the difference of the aristocracy. All the signs of the aristocracy, which was ruling the separate German states, after all, which was preventing unity, burned all of those on their fire as well. So you have in Wartburg also a liturgy, the fire, the taking of oath, in imitation of the Christian liturgy itself. After that, of course, the fraternities were banned by the European reaction. After that, for a while, the fraternity movement went underground to surface again, of course, as a nationalist but social movement in the 1860s, still agitating for national unification, but becoming more and more a drinking and dueling society, something the early fraternities had despised. More and more a drinking and dueling society as their importance in the struggle for national unification becomes less and less, and others take up the cudgel. So what you have, therefore, is the fraternity movement. One final word about the fraternity movement. What it meant is, of course, that German students radicalized themselves to the right, not to the left. You take it for granted, stupidly, because it is, of course, not true, that students in the Third World radicalize themselves to the left. They're just like the German students in 1813. They want national unification, so they radicalize themselves to the right, not to the left. Students who want national unification radicalize themselves to the right. They become nationalists above all, nationalists above all. So that youth in Germany, bourgeois youth, you might remember that for the future, now radicalizes itself to the right. Not French bourgeois youth, not at all, because France was a unified nation. Not English bourgeois youth, but you might say, as the fraternities spread into Central Europe, all the youth of Central Europe radicalized themselves to the right instead of the left in quest of national unification. That was to be, of course, fateful. Quite fateful in the end. And it gave again, as an underground movement, to nationalism an aggressive edge. The second movement Father Jahn founded were the gymnasts. Now, again, the gymnasts were founded to steal the body of those who would have to fight. Again, it was in the beginning a student movement. Students meeting on a meadow outside Berlin to do something nobody had ever really done, to do gymnastics in order to become fit. Fit for what? Fit to fight the French. But these gymnastic exercises in the famous Hasenheide in the meadow outside Berlin were surrounded by national symbols. They usually sung a national song at first. They were surrounded by certain national symbols. Now, the gymnastic movement is doubly important, for it did not remain a student movement. because it coincided with new ideas of health, new ideas of sanitation, new ideas of physical fitness. And so the gymnastic movement very briefly spread out beyond the students, not only to the middle classes, but even to the working classes as well. And the gymnastic movement, within a decade, very soon, became a general German movement, a general movement, where every town would have its gymnastics society, which would go out and do gymnastics and have gymnastic competitions, but which remained patriotic. That is, we are at a point now, a point which is all too familiar to you, where nobody does sport anymore for its own sake, but rather for the sake of the nation, or for the sake of winning, or for the sake of something that has nothing to do with the exercise, but a lot to do with irrational sentiment, as those of you who go to football games should know. So that what you have therefore here then is sport integrated into the national endeavor. Fit bodies to fight for the nation. Fit bodies to fight for the nation. Gymnastics comes first, but other sport follows very shortly. Now, what happens therefore here then is the gymnastics. To this we must add a third, very briefly, not founded by Jahn, that is to say, the third popular kind of movement, the choir movement, male choir or glee club movement, a result of the lay that music became a lay activity in the 18th century. A lay activity, by the beginning of the 19th century, it becomes a mass lay activity, but again used for patriotic end, though not as much as the fraternities or the gymnasts. Eventually, the local glee club would sing at any function. They were happy to sing. They didn't ask about the functions very much in the end, yes? While gymnastics and fraternities were always pioneers in Central Europe of the national cause, fit for wars, against the French, and against, in the end, of course, against everything that was not German. Finally, you must put as an institutionalization not only these organizations in a disunited nation, remember, not only these organizations, but also the political liturgy I talked about. That is to say, the festivals, national festivals. The first great one in Germany at Hambach, I won't bother you with it, where about 8,000 Germans marched to a castle as a symbol of national unity. But the building of national monuments, which now begins, the building of national monuments as sites or background on which to have your folk dances, the right surroundings, the church in a way, to have your kind of nationalist liturgy. And most national monuments were built in this period, in Greek style, in old Germanic style, with old Germanic figures, in old Germanic sacred places, like the Teutoburger Forest with its old remnants of the ancient Germans. Always historic places, which means places which have a historical continuity, if possible with the old Germans, certainly with the Middle Ages, at any rate. And at the same time, sometimes figures, sometimes monuments, sometimes Greek temples, but this is the time when these things become extremely important in a disunited nation, though you find them built in France as well at the same time, and even in England. Now, all of this then gives body to the theory of nationalism. All of this, as it were, gives it a dimension of reality. For nothing will come reality unless it is institutionalized in one sense or another, unless there is a continuity. Remember that. It's always very easy to make a riot. It's very difficult to institutionalize the riot. Otherwise, it's no good. Otherwise, that's no good at all. Anybody can make a riot, but the institutionalization is important here. And nationalism took off, if you like, became the great religion of the future, because it coincided then with the wars of the French Revolution, with the institutionalizing, with bourgeois society beginning to close in, the respectabilities, the emphasis on family life, and the young people wanting to get out of their new cage, wanting adventure, wanting to have meaningful lives, volunteering for the colors, so that it fulfills a function for the elite, but only for the elite, but that's what's important and articulate and what makes the myth for the elite. It fills a very definite function. So that from now on, these are the decisive wars. The First World War will add very little to it. The generation of 1914 is just another edition of the generation of 1813. In the First World War, the same soldier songs were sung that these Free Corps sang in 1813. Schiller's song, Uhland's song, the songs that I quoted to you just a few minutes ago. Now, so deep did that get, of course, into our civilization, that from this time on, there is a basic assumption you all make. United nations are better than divided nations, which is nonsense. Germany was much happier before it was ever united, and is much happier now that it is again divided. In other words, you get this idea, so stupid and causing so many loss of life and death today in the Third World, that national unity will solve all problems. That's, of course, again, a nationalist and then a racist idea. If you can only have national unity, all your problems will be solved through your death for the fatherland. There is some truth to that, of course, but not the truth that they really mean. That national unity will solve all problems. Greatest nonsense, of course, but people don't learn from past experience. It not only does not solve any problems, because makes many more problems than it solves. But we take it for granted today that national unity is a good, that divided nations are worse off than united nations. And history should teach us that that was a lie. Now, what you have therefore, but it is then connected, of course, with the great power complex, with reaching for world power, and the odd idea that it's much better to live in a big power than it is to live in a Sweden. I would much rather live in Sweden than in a big power, which has a big power complex and which may lead to all of our deaths sooner or later. So all this we assume from this time, so deep has nationalism gone, so deep has nationalism penetrated, so deep has this myth penetrated, of the glory of the death for the fatherland. What you have therefore here is then a new myth and powerful symbols arising. Powerful everywhere in the end, so that they lead to basic presuppositions. And I am stressing this for the reason not only that you should think about the presuppositions always on which politics rests, but not only about this, so deep it is that in the end, of course, in modern times, nationalism will win over any other ideology, whether it is socialism, Marxism, anything. In the end, it will make a compromise with nationalism, and it will be nationalism that wins. Nationalism that wins. And death for the fatherland remains glorious, an unknown glory I wish, well, America's already back with a mercenary army, so I don't know what the future is. But what you have on the whole then is this kind of idea, victorious. Now, with all of this, hoping having made clear to you, we must now come to the summary of all of this. And the summary of all of this, what we have done, is the greatest system of thought since Aristotle, more important for modern times than Aristotle, the system of thought of Hegel. And Hegel's system of thought is so important because it is a summary of so much which agitated this generation of Hegel himself and the generations to come. Hegel's own life from 1770 to 1830 spans all that we have discussed up to now. The French Revolution, the wars, the Enlightenment, Romanticism, the growth of nationalism, all these important themes that we have dealt with, Hegel's life spans from 1770 to 1831. And his system pulls them all into a unity. And this may have been the puzzling effectiveness of the system. For Hegel himself was quite ineffective. He was probably one of the worst university lecturers ever. He never had more than 3 or 4 listeners at his lectures. He is not easy to read. You will probably agree with me. But though he is not easy to read, very difficult to read, obscure would be a good word, his meanings are often hidden. Yet that hidden, obscure doctrine put forth in a most dry way by one of the dullest of all men, that doctrine caught on more than any other. It inspired the right and the left. But above all, it was to inspire youth looking for a system, looking for something to give their life meaning in the 1840s. What we call the young Hegelians, of which Karl Marx was one. The young Hegelians, with Karl Marx and others, caught fire in this system. And anything which Karl Marx learned in France, and there's a lot of which Karl Marx learned in his stay in Paris earlier, he learned about socialism in France. That was nothing compared with the way this system ignited his imagination, gave him really what he wanted, though he was to reject much of it, regardless. But it isn't only Marx. The whole youth of the 1840s was ignited, some to the left, as we would say, and some to the right. And the puzzling question of why Hegel's system is so much more important than that of Kant or even that of the Romantic philosophers, that whole question can still not be answered, though Hegel is on and on and on. And today I would say what is important among the left is not Marx, it is Hegel. What has proved, if you look today at the Frankfurt School, at all the new left ideas, Marcuse, all of the things that you know, have very little to do with Karl Marx. Karl Marx has turned out to be a man of one season, but Hegel's philosophy has turned out to be something for all seasons, which you can still read today if you read magazines like New German Critique, edited here, or Telos, another product of Madison. In fact, you can say, oddly enough, that Madison became one of the founts of the American, of the spreading of the, in America, of the Hegelian ideas. of mediation and consciousness and all the things that we should talk about, of a way of analyzing reality, which has a lot to do with both history on the one hand and man's consciousness on the other, with the importance of how reality is mediated through your consciousness and the importance to have right or false consciousness about the future and the class struggle. That all of these things, which are Hegel, much more than Marx, of course, have lasted and have still lasted, are of vast, vast influence today, is something that I can only explain by the fact that Hegel gives you a system, a way of looking at the world, which combines, if you like, realism and idealism, by which I mean that combines a way of looking at history with individualism, with a way of looking at your own self and the development of your own self-consciousness. It takes care of individualism on the one hand and collectivity on the other. And it takes care of individualism on the one hand and collectivity on the other, and wraps it up in the mantle of freedom and progress, so that you have freedom and progress. Progress to what? To the abolition of the division of labor. Progress to something that will be of the essence of Marx, but you first find in Hegel, of course, the abolition of the division of labor. That is to say, let me put it another way, of recapturing the totality of experience. And I really think that the clue, myself, to why that system that we are about to study now has lasted and is a lasting legacy, because it fulfills the longing for totality that we all have, the longing for totality in a world of the division of labor, in a world of fragmentation. And it fulfills this longing for totality within the assumption of the inevitable growth of freedom. And freedom is not merely material freedom, it is both. It is material freedom and the freedom of the individual. Material freedom and the growth of your self-consciousness. And in an industrial society where you have the division of labor, which I used to explain by the people who wash up in the union. You look through this little thing in the union and you see these slaves, you know, washing. Or you could do this with baking, you see. The division of labor, all he does is bake here. Yes? And he has, therefore, a longing for totality, a longing for something more total, for the abolition of the division of labor. Or as Marx put it in this wonderful phrase, reactionary phrase, as so much of Marx, hunting in the morning and fishing in the afternoon, which is Marx's only description of the classless society. Hunting in the morning and fishing in the afternoon. And as I am an anti-vivisectionist, and I don't believe in either hunting or fishing. So I don't approve of this in the slightest. But what Marx meant to say by using this metaphor, which of course it is that in the classless society there will be totality. And that idea of totality took from Hegel, because it is a totality that takes an account of two things, which none of what we have studied before really took account of in this particular way. Individualism. All right, we've studied Rousseau, who has this continuous attraction. We've studied others. And collectivity, all right? We have the new nation, community of affinity. But nobody really, up to this point, has made a final stress that what is really important in the last line, in the last resort, is not individuality or collectivity, but the totality. That you must integrate yourself, not necessarily with the state, that is the old Hegel, a misconception about him. That's only the old Hegel. Not necessarily with the state, and then a kind of a state, but you must integrate yourself with history and with yourself. With history and with yourself. With the growth of your own self-consciousness. And this was to have a lasting and tremendous effect. Now, with all of this said, let us then look at Hegel himself and at your reading of Hegel to see where we are and where we are going in a concrete way. But keep in mind what I have said in the last resort, why he has lasted, and what his real basic appeal was. It will help you read it. It will help you understand why what will be so difficult for you to read, which needs so much explanation, had such an enormous appeal. Now, Karl Marx really summarizes what I just said before I come, which I have to do next time. Marx said the outstanding thing about Hegel's phenomenology, he meant, is that he grasped the self-creation of man as a process. And what Karl Marx meant by that is that he grasps how man's consciousness grows as a process, how man's self-consciousness grows as a process, the process of human self-consciousness as a process, how it grows in collaboration with history. Because by process, Marx meant history. That the great thing about Marx, about Hegel, Marx says, is that he grasped that man's self-consciousness grows. And that it grows hand in hand with the progress of history. And the more history progresses, the more man's self-consciousness progresses. The more he understands the world of a totality. For the progression of man's self-consciousness is to lead to an understanding of the world as a totality. And therefore, history and self-consciousness interact. That is the most difficult thing for you to understand in Hegel. In the end, that's going to be the most difficult thing. That you can't divorce the individual from history. That's going to be very difficult. Because in a sense, we automatically know, especially in your own liberal atmosphere, coming from liberalism, you divorce the individual from history and almost everything else. You have the individual stand on his own feet. So that the most difficult thing as you now read Hegel, the most difficult thing for you to grasp, but you must grasp it, that for Hegel, as indeed for nationalism, for community, for all that we have discussed, the individual cannot be divorced from history. History is a part of him, as much as food and eating and drinking. History is a part of him. And history is progress. So that these two things are closely linked. With that on Wednesday, I want to come to the greater detail of Hegel then.